So my name is Jim Freeman. I'm a cardiac electrophysiologist. I'm an arrhythmia specialist, and I direct the cardiac electrophysiology laboratories at Yale New Haven Health up in New Haven, Connecticut, and across the state of Connecticut. And I also run our atrial fibrillation program at Yale.
So I am talking to the right person when it comes to atrial fibrillation. Explain to our listeners what AFib is.
So atrial fibrillation is the most common cardiac arrhythmia. In the normal heart, we generate electricity in the top of the heart and some pacemaker cells, and that electricity propagates down to the bottom chambers of the heart, and that's what tells the heart to beat. Atrial fibrillation is a chaotic electrical pattern in the upper chambers of the heart, and it has two primary consequences. Generally, it can cause patients to have symptoms, including shortness of breath, palpitations, in some cases, lightheadedness. And the second is that it increases the risk of stroke, on average, about fivefold. And we vary that sense of how much stroke risk is increased based on patient's risk factors.
Sometimes somebody can faint.
It's possible. It's not the most common symptom. In fact, I'd say it's relatively rare with atrial fibrillation, but it's not uncommon that patients will feel some lightheadedness. But true fainting is a little bit less common with AFib.
Okay. Is there one reason why someone would develop AFib?
That's a really great question. Atrial fibrillation impacts about 15 to 20% of the U.S. population, and it predominantly impacts people over the age of 65. So about 5% of people will develop atrial fibrillation by the time they're 65, and then that gets up to 10 to 15% of the population by the time they're 80. So the biggest risk factor is age. But other risk factors can contribute, including high blood pressure, people that are overweight, and then there are probably genetic factors as well that we're still working out as a field.
Obesity is not a good partner for AFib, is it? I was reading about how if you're obese, the number of pounds that you lose can affect the severity of the symptoms. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So there have been a number of studies actually led by a close friend of mine, a colleague in Australia. In Australia, some of the more advanced therapies, it's a little harder to get compared to the United States. And so they've really pioneered a lot of the work looking at behavior modification, some of the behavioral risk factors for atrial fibrillation. And what they found is that a diet and exercise can make a big difference. So people that are overweight are at a markedly increased risk of atrial fibrillation. But we know that if they lose weight and exercise, that that can reduce that risk pretty substantially. We also know that alcohol is a big trigger for atrial fibrillation, and the reduction in alcohol use, again, can be associated with decreases in the risk of atrial fibrillation. And then lastly, the other big one that has been identified is obstructive sleep apnea. And so sleep apnea treatment can also be an important treatment for patients with atrial fibrillation. Obstructive sleep apnea is also closely correlated with increased weight. So people that are heavier tend to have more obstructive sleep apnea. So those two are synergistic. And similarly, alcohol is calories. And so we know that our patients that drink less often will have a side benefit of losing some weight as well.
How is atrial fibrillation treated in 2021? I understand that there are new medications and also a new device. Let's talk about the meds first.
Yeah, so when we talk about treatment for atrial fibrillation, we need to really separate out the two aspects of the disease. The first is symptomatology. So about 65% of patients will have substantial symptoms associated with their atrial fibrillation, and anywhere between 15 and 20% of patients will report severe disabling symptoms. And so for those people, we try and control the rhythm itself. And we can do that with medications, many of which have been around for years. And then increasingly, we'll use a procedure called ablation. And what that involves is using a catheter-based technology to either do some freezing or some burning on the inside of the heart to get rid of the electrical triggers that kick off the atrial fibrillation. The other big consequence of atrial fibrillation is stroke. For many of our patients with atrial fibrillation, they'll have a risk factor profile that puts them at a relatively high risk for stroke, in which case we often will use anticoagulant medicines or blood thinners to try and prevent strokes from occurring in atrial fibrillation. And then more recently, we use a procedure called left atrial appendage closure, which allows us to mitigate the risk of stroke using a procedure-based technology and allows us to then get patients off of blood thinners.
The ablation you talked about sounds serious, is it?
That procedure generally takes on the order of 2 to 5 hours. It's often under general anesthesia in the United States, although some places will do it with sedation, similar to what you get during a colonoscopy. overall, the complication rate of that procedure is quite low, and it's generally done quite safely. And it's done in the United States in estimated about 100,000 people per year right now. So I think increasingly done, the safety profile has markedly improved. We've published data showing that over time. And, you know, our equipment and technology has markedly improved as well. It's not a curative procedure per se. We know that we can markedly reduce the burden of AFib in the vast majority of patients who undergo the procedure, but completely eliminating it can be a little bit harder to achieve with ablation. And sometimes it takes ablation and medications or even multiple ablations.
I've been hearing about this device called the Watchman. Is that something new?
So the Watchman device is one of the devices that falls into that category of the procedure that I was talking about earlier, left atrial appendage closure. The Watchman is actually the only commercially available device in the United States right now, although another device is likely to be made commercially available in the U.S. in the next 6 to 12 months and has been used in Europe for quite some time. The Watchman has been done in over 100,000 people in the United States over the last 5 years. We actually run the national registry, which includes the vast majority of those procedures performed in the United States. And this is increasingly being done. The reason that we have this Watchman procedure is that while anticoagulants and blood thinners are a very effective technology, we know that about 50%, anywhere between 40 and 50% of patients who meet indication for being on blood thinners will have some kind of bleeding or other problem that makes it difficult for them to take blood thinners. And so this procedure was really invented to try and help those patients who are caught between a rock and a hard place, who have both a risk for stroke and atrial fibrillation and a risk for bleeding. And what it involves is going up with a catheter through the groin. We go up into the heart. We cross over from the right to the left-hand side of the heart using a small hole that closes up within about a month. And then we deploy essentially a plug-like device in the opening of the left atrial appendage, which is an appendage of tissue that hangs off the left atrium. And that's the location where the vast majority of blood clots form in atrial fibrillation that result in stroke. And so by plugging that up, we can prevent those clots from forming and we can prevent those strokes. This has been shown to be roughly comparable in terms of stroke prevention to what we get with anticoagulants. Just to be clear, the Watchman device does not alter the rhythm. So the ablation procedure is really dedicated to getting the patient back into rhythm. And the Watchman device doesn't impact the patient's rhythm, but its job is to mitigate the risk of stroke in patients who have atrial fibrillation. Got so they it. Sort of tackle gotcha. Two different pieces of the puzzle. The ablation is really to try and impact the rhythm itself and some of the symptoms and other consequences. The Watchman is really about trying to mitigate the risk of stroke, as is the anticoagulation.
Okay. There is a new med, edoxaban. Why is that important?
So edoxaban is part of a class of medicines that have been called the novel anticoagulants or the direct oral anticoagulants. So edoxaban is the newest of the medications, but there are several that have been out for years, including dabigatran, apixaban, and rivaroxaban that all predated edoxaban. Edoxaban is actually used less commonly in the United States, and the market share is mostly dominated by rivaroxaban and apixaban, which are known as Xarelto and Eliquis. But edoxaban is the new kid on the block. And these drugs are thrombin inhibitors or basically impact a part of the coagulation cascade that results in clotting. And the nice thing about these new medications is the older medication we had that was a blood thinner was called warfarin or Coumadin. Mm-hmm. And that required frequent laboratory testing. The effectiveness of it varied according to what foods people were eating. So green leafy vegetables can impact how effective it is. And so these newer medicines don't require any of that laboratory monitoring. They're not really impacted by dietary changes. And so they're just much easier to administer and use. The one downside to them is that they tend to be substantially more expensive because they're all still on patent. Mm. And so that can be a barrier for patients.
How do you know which route to go to treat your atrial fibrillation? How would a cardiologist or a doctor monitoring a patient decide between maybe the Watchman or edoxaban?
You know, the standard of care in the United States right now remains using a blood thinner. And the U.S. guidelines and the European guidelines have both stated a preference for the newer agents. So those would be the four drugs we talked about compared to warfarin. And so that's generally going to be first line therapy for patients who are diagnosed with atrial fibrillation and who have risk factors like high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, age greater than 65, a prior history of stroke or TIA, prior history of heart attack. So people that have atrial fibrillation and some of these risk factors will generally be deemed at adequate risk to need some kind of stroke prevention strategy. Mm. Generally, first line therapy will be these blood thinner medicines. And then for the patients that have bleeding or other reasons that they can't take those medicines, increasingly we will consider the Watchman procedure or other left atrial appendage closure technologies as they're approved in the United States.
But people who are on the blood thinners, they would take them for life.
So that's a very important point. We generally recommend indefinite use of these blood thinners. That's really why this procedural option was invented, because as people age over time and are on blood thinners for often years to decades, they can have bleeding events or other issues. And I should also say that there are a number of ongoing randomized trials looking at whether we should be considering some of these procedural options in basically everyone. So not just the people who have had bleeding problems, which is who we currently use it on, but everyone. But that remains to be seen. So for now, first-line therapy remains the blood thinners. It's also important to note that even if we get the AFib under control in terms of the rhythm itself with the ablation or with rhythm control medicines, we think that our current understanding is that there still is residual risk of stroke. And so we still generally recommend some long-term stroke prevention strategy for many of these patients.
This is going to sound like a harsh question, but can patients be considered to have done this to themselves through bad lifestyle choices, or is it one of those things that happen because they have the hearts that they have, or both?
Like so many health conditions, I mean, we know that there are definitely modifiable risk factors, so things that people are doing that can contribute to their risk of atrial fibrillation. And then there are things that are clearly guiding their risk for atrial fibrillation,
yeah,
you know, in the form of their genetics and their genetic background that may make them predisposed to this condition and over which they have no control. So we've certainly seen the gamut. And, you know, we see plenty of patients, and I would say the majority of our patients who are dealing with weight issues or maybe drinking a little too much and may have untreated obstructive sleep apnea or other things. But we certainly have plenty of patients who are considered in a healthy weight category and are young and have really healthy lifestyles and still have atrial fibrillation. Yeah. I hesitate to mention this, but there is also some data that people that do extremes of exercise may have an increased risk of atrial fibrillation. So that's going to be a very tiny minority of the U.S. population. But there is some data to suggest that, you know, ultra marathon runners and others may be at slightly higher risk of AFib.
Yeah.
But we strongly recommend diet, you know, diet modification, keeping a normal weight and exercise for the vast majority of our patients. And it's pretty clear that alcohol is a strong driver of AFib as well.
COVID, how has COVID played with your patients?
So there's a really interesting interplay between COVID and atrial fibrillation. There have been a number of reports, including our own, that have suggested that infection with a coronavirus can increase the risk of atrial fibrillation. And what we also know is that amongst patients with COVID who have AFib, their risk of doing poorly with the COVID is substantially higher. So our data and others has suggested that there's an increased risk of death and longer hospitalizations in patients who have both coronavirus and atrial fibrillation. There's also been some newer data to suggest that even in the general population who may not have gotten COVID, the risk of atrial fibrillation may have gone up during the COVID era. And you can imagine that that's tied in with some of what we've already talked about earlier. So people were exercising a little less during the pandemic because their gym routines and other routines were thrown off. There's some data to suggest that people were drinking more alcohol during that period. People were more sedentary, gaining weight. So some of these behavior changes may have led to an epidemiologic increase in AFib. But, you know, that data is still early, but that does seem to be a connection as well.
My favorite question, and this is one of the last ones, if not the last one, I'm curious about how you decided to become a cardiologist.
So that's a really great question. So we don't have doctors in my family, but my dad was always somewhat interested in medicine. And I think I had an early proclivity for the sciences, and Really enjoyed science and then had some exposure during college and after college to medicine. I spent some time after college working in East Africa with patients with HIV. And so when I went into medical school, I was actually thinking I was going to be an infectious diseases specialist, but developed a real interest in cardiology. You know, cardiology, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death on every continent but Africa. And so just huge public health implications in treating cardiovascular disease. And then I also love the procedural aspect. I really love working with my hands. I've been a lifelong athlete, and I really enjoy that aspect of being able to go in and help a patient with a procedure and make a big difference in their lives. So I think that combination led me to cardiology and then particularly to this field of cardiac electrophysiology or the arrhythmia space in cardiology, which is a really dynamic and exciting field. And I think I'm biased, but I think the best field in medicine. So I've really enjoyed my career and feel very, very lucky to be able to be in this space.
Well, I'm lucky that you agreed to talk to me today, and your passion is really contagious. So I thank you again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk.